The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Welcome back to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia. This is Gary Heasley, your host, and with me is Ada Nestor, who's been our co-host here for the last few weeks and has been joining these conversations. We have on the line someone we spoke to last week, Darren Gobb, who's the co-founder of Restore Liberty, a group, and then also the chairman of the Republican Committee of Lewis and Clark County, Montana. And Darren, you can follow on his Substack. If you go to Substack and search for Darren, D-A-R-I-N, Gobb, G-A-U-B, and there you'll find some great writing, one that we were talking about last week, which we may get to in a little bit, that is titled Failure is the Plan. So I encourage you to go to Substack and find Darren's work. Darren also, we've come to understand, is on Newsmax all the time. I didn't know that originally, but I've been trying to catch those episodes on Newsmax where you appear and your commentary's fantastic. Darren, welcome back to the Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back on. It's always a pleasure to join you from the mountains of Western Montana.
Oh, yeah.
Always rubbing that in.
That's
always
right.
Rubbing that in.
I can't help it. I can't help it.
Well, I'll tell you, Pennsylvania is a beautiful state.
Yes.
But there are certain parts of Pennsylvania that aren't. And I was driving through parts of Philadelphia recently, and I couldn't believe how bad the roads were. And just how dilapidated things are.
The roads in Pennsylvania, that's our signature, is terrible, terrible roads.
Well, but that said, we've got an $8 billion slush fund in the government that they're not giving back while they continue to raise school board taxes and other taxes. And I was surprised as well at how run down some elements of Philadelphia are. You know, this is a major American city. It should look great. It doesn't in many places. Some places it's beautiful. It just depends on where the money's going and who's investing. So
well,
yeah.
I'll tell you, if I could tell you a good news story, though, for Pennsylvania for me, if you'll allow it.
Yeah, sure.
I was up in a station in Fort Drum, New York, north of Syracuse, flying an aircraft down to Virginia. I was a Black Hawk guy for my career as an officer and ran into some weather, and I ended up landing in a farmer's field just south of the north side of the Pennsylvania border there. And we got treated like kings. We had to sleep in the aircraft and everything like that, but we had some really nasty weather that we ran into.
Uh-huh.
There's this farmer looks out his house window, and there is us in an aircraft shutting down in his field.
Oh.
And that guy come rolling up on us in a dune buggy with all kinds of bells and whistles and brought us pizza and, you know, checked on us through the day and everything while we were waiting. And so, you know, my experience with Pennsylvania, that part of Pennsylvania specifically, was I loved it. And,
well,
there's some good, solid Americans out there.
Oh, there really are. And you know, if you drive across this state from, you know, east to west, north to south, it is beautiful. It is stunningly beautiful, but the people make it even better. You're right. It is a state full of wonderful folks. And we're lucky we get to see some of them. Now, we do town halls about every 2 weeks in Chester County at the Desmond Hotel in Malvern. We'll be doing one next Thursday at 7 p.m. Keystone Town Halls. So if listeners want to join us, please do. But when we get into those conversations, the discussions we have in our town halls are with just great people, and they're very informed and they care. They're not just passive, they care and they're active. So it's a wonderful time.
The unintended consequences, again, we talk about all the time, of the 2020 election. All the people who just wanted to be left alone and to sit on their couch got up off their couch and said, oh, I guess I need to get involved now. I guess I need to learn something. I guess I need to say something. So, you know, that march has been since 2020, I think, accelerated for sure,
yeah,
in
well,
our area.
And that's the beauty of these conversations we have at our town halls and on this show. Is we get to talk to folks who really know a lot, have done a lot, and you know, have good questions that we all get to debate. So yeah, any listeners that are out there, if you want to join us next Thursday at the Desmond Hotel at 7 o'clock, we'll do another town hall, and it should be an enjoyable evening. Now, one comment, Darren, we've made several times through this first hour of the show and now is the incredible, dramatic time we're living in. It's just constant, a constant flood of dramatic things. One of the things that you've been commenting on and analyzing, given your background, is this thing with Iran. I mean, we all remember when they tried to get Donald Trump to attack Iran and he called the planes back. And now we're in a position where
we're deploying troops.
I was checking the news when I was traveling recently just to see if it was today that we went to full-on war with Iran. Darren, what is your view of this? What do you think is going on and what is coming?
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch this. I mean, the hard part has been trying to put the pieces together for in an understandable way for everybody to grasp onto those and of course, agree or disagree with the conclusions. But, you know, to understand what's going on with Iran right now, you got to go back to August of 2021 and the disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan, which, you know, that was called a non-combatant evacuation operation, a plan that which I wrote when I was there as a planner. And of course, it was supposed to happen out of Bagram.
Right.
So the whole thing was messed up. But when you take that event, the message it sent to our adversaries around the world and potential future adversaries was that we were weak, we didn't know what we were doing, and we're just going to cut and run. Doesn't matter whether we disagree or agree with that statement, it's what our enemy sees. So you take that, you then add in what we predicted in our organization was that Ukraine was going to be next, and then the Middle East would flare up, and then China would continue to be militaristic and seek to expand because they had a window of opportunity with this White House, this administration, and what they were doing. And that's a very broad simplification. But, you know, in the middle of all that, we predicted that the Middle East would flare up again. And this is just the result of that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more than just the military side of things, Hamas attacking or Israel's response in Gaza Strip, the bleed over into Lebanon, with specifically with Hezbollah, because this is Hezbollah, not Lebanon itself.
Yeah.
It's two different things.
Yeah.
And then our freeing up of Iran by removing the sanction, allowing them to sell oil to China, allowing them to bank a whole bunch of money, continue to fund these little proxy mercenary armies that they've liked to use throughout the years. And so the natural consequence then becomes an emboldened Iran, a better funded Iran, and one that sees the potential for a weak administration to try to pursue nuclear deals, which allows Iran to build nuclear weapons because they want to be on par with, mostly us, but frankly also be the biggest player in Middle East and Central Asia, along with their friends Russia, China, North Korea, and that little axis of evil. So this seems to be, for people who are in the national security world, like myself, who are honest about everything we see and just kind of call balls and strikes, we say, this is not current news to us. This is an expected outcome given what we've seen over the last 3 or 4 years. And so it's disappointing to see it. You hate to see it come, but it's exactly what we expected. And where is it going? It'll depend on the number of nations throughout the Middle East, Central Asia, who look to Iran and say, you know, knock it off. Ultimately, they're in many cases not interested in a broadening war throughout the region when it could be confined to the limits of which it's at now. And those nations are not necessarily always Israel friends or necessarily aligned with the West purely. We're talking Jordan, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and others that have come together and said, hey, listen, no, we can't have this. And even Egypt too, a little bit. But it depends on who Iran is listening to and what they do, because at this point, Khamenei's leveled the threat. And to back down completely is a risk to him to some extent. But to go forward with full bore with the level of threats that he's made could also be a significant threat to him, not only because of the external nations, but his own population, the majority of which are really not a fan of that, the thug state and the military he uses that are mostly pointed inwards, not outwards. So I hope that helps understand it a little bit on a very broad brush.
What's interesting about everything that we're seeing, on top of the fact that, as you said, it was all predictable. Mm-hmm. I mean, any of us in 2020 knew what could happen in the next 4 years with a weaker president or a president who's somewhat compromised by different nations like Ukraine and China. It's wild to see it come together in such a way where it is so obvious. It is stunning to me that we're only now just kind of getting out into the public domain the amount of money we've been giving the Taliban in cash every single week. Mm-hmm. You know, when we, before Russia invaded Ukraine, Biden had shut down U.S. oil production to the level of which he could, and we were buying oil from Russia. So anytime we start sending money to these countries and it emboldens them, it finances their future plans. So it's cause and effect. And we're able to follow the cause all the way to today to see the effects of it. And so, you know, back to your article, was it on purpose? Are they failing on purpose? Was it intentional? Is there a reason they need a wider scale war or a world war to advance their, I guess, ideology or whatever their plans are? Because it looks like we're just on a march to whichever war we can escalate. You know, we have multiple conflicts right now. It's almost like pick and choose whichever one they can make a larger scale event or a World War III. And we're dealing with the U.S. allied countries and then the BRICS allied countries. They have their own plans for their future. So it does seem larger or more perilous than it did 4 years ago, now that we're at a culmination, seeing all three of these nations sort of take events or actions to further their own ideas.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the lesson that has been learned specifically by China and others, that with the United States, you can't just give us one problem.
Right.
You're going to have to give us five or six.
Right.
And, you know, we may or may not be able to handle those. But if you're talking about like three or four major conflicts around the country, around the world, that for some odd reason we seem like we have to get involved in,
right,
then we're not going to be able to do that. Now, some may say that we're not necessarily involved troops on the ground in Ukraine, which, by the way, is not true.
That is false.
Right.
There's
yeah.
just not many troops
right.
on the ground. But look at all the munitions, the equipment, everything else has gone there. All of that is resources that we had either in stockpiles or elsewhere that we now don't. And, you know, granted, we're rebuilding behind that to a point, but, and I could tell stories all day long about things that have been just plain wasted because we're just destroying them for no reason. But, if you create the Ukraine-Russia problem, then you create the Middle East problem, you create the China problem. And, oh, by the way, part of the China problem is, in southern Texas and now across all the cities in the United States.
Right.
What you've got, and out west, you know, this is one of those things, is we have forest fires all the time.
Yep.
Firefighters would rather put out a fire that's, you know, 100 acres, but in one place. But as soon as those spot fires show up in multiple places throughout a region in the west, now you have a serious problem. So those spot fires are all these conflicts. They're our debt. They're our border. They're Chinese influence through Confucius academies. I mean, you could make a list. I'm sure all of us could sit down and just put a whiteboard up and list 150 things, you know, minimum on a board that are these spot fires. They become very hard to put out. That's what they've learned about us. And we have to be able to look at this from more than just a military perspective. Most people don't know, as a military strategist and planner, we looked at the military forces last.
Right.
We look at diplomatic information, economics, currencies, and whatever else, and we try to do everything we possibly could to avoid the use of military forces. And so that's why we get really good at looking at a lot of other options that others may not look at, because executives love to just say, hey, the military's mine, I'm going to use them, even though that's against the Constitution. But, you know, why worry about our little things like that, right?
Right. Well, that's why as we've talked about before, we've been in war basically my entire life.
Yeah.
every living adult American, we've been at war their whole lives, right? Effectively. I mean, it was a year off here or there, but basically we're in some conflict somewhere in the world forever, permanently, everywhere, always, or we're somewhere always. And yet we haven't even declared a war since World War II. Right. We haven't declared a war since World War II. It's hard to process that and understand how we keep going into these battles without having the debate in Congress that the Constitution calls for. But we don't have that debate, and we don't often have the debate about how a given war is important to some child growing up in Philadelphia, to right. some child growing up in California. You know, how is this war important to their future? How is this war important to our nationals? We don't really have robust debate around that. And so we stumble into these wars. And I think that one of the problems we have is that the American people have so much faith and trust in our military that we believe that we're capable of doing anything and winning. We can affect change anywhere in the world we want, enter any battle in the world we want. And so we don't have to think about the things you just mentioned, considering, you know, economics and what the state of a nation's morale is and what their politics are. We don't have to worry about that because we've got this giant hammer that is incapable of losing. And of course, that defies logic when you look at what's actually gone on. I mean, Bagram, you mentioned earlier, that was the best air base in that part of the world.
Yeah.
And we pulled out of there, and the Chinese were in what, 3 days?
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, here's a little nugget for everybody. As a guy who spent 2 years of my four in Afghanistan in Bagram, China's been in Afghanistan since 2004, at least. I saw them there at that time, and they were raking in mining claims and mineral rights and stuff then.
Mm-hmm.
So China's always been involved in Afghanistan.
Yep.
And they weren't really even hiding it, but we were hiding it.
Right. We didn't want... So the American public... That's a really critical piece of information, right? That they were there the whole time and that they were there to go after the minerals, that we had this insane pullout driven by the same people who want to continue running our government, right? The Harris administration will just be an extension of whatever the Biden administration has been because she will be answering to the same people that control him. So if she were to win, we'd continue this approach where they said, okay, we're just going to run away from Bagram. We're going to run away from Afghanistan. We don't care about the people that get killed. That's obvious, right? They don't care who gets hurt. They don't care about the military folks that are serving on those front lines. And then a few days later, China isn't just coming into the country for the first time, but expanding. And they're laying out their economic and political reasons for doing so. They've got a massive interest in the minerals and materials that can be mined out of there. And they've got the capital to buy whoever they need to buy in Afghanistan to give them free passage to do that. So the real implications of pulling out of something like that after 20 years of fighting, I just don't know that the average American really grasps it. They some of the people in this country think about the needless loss of life in that pullout, but most people don't seem to really think beyond that and be thinking about, you know, for example, the folks we left behind who are American citizens, who got zero media coverage, zero interest, zero concern.
The translators we left behind who worked with our service members for years and years at great risk to themselves were left behind.
Yeah, and we haven't counted those bodies.
Yeah.
So when we think about this thing in Iran, this is much more complicated than people think. And I just don't understand am I correct or incorrect in this view that somehow the American people seem to think if we go to war with Iran, we just go in and take out Iran, and that's that. I mean, it just seems like it's harder than that.
If it was that easy, wouldn't it have already
been
done?
Last time I heard that argument used... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
What's, no, please, go ahead.
Say that again?
Yeah. No, last time I heard that argument used, I believe someone said when we went into Iraq that once you break it, you buy it. And there are ways to leverage Iran without having to do something like in Iraq, when Iran is much bigger, much more difficult terrain, much more mature military system, especially when it comes to things like air defense. And we could go into all that, but it comes down to the question of why would we? And we can go ahead and do what we did under the Trump administration and maybe some other little things too to help. But what did he do? Well, he crushed them with the harshest economics or sanctions you can imagine.
Right.
And there was more you could do in that region as well. But if you take the money, then you largely take everything that they were using to keep their position in place. If you tell them straight up you're not going to deal with them on nuclear power in any way, shape, or form, then you take away their leverage. And you never have to apply a single piece of military force at all. That threat is always there. But you can get the results in much less expensive ways. Put all the cost on them and none of the cost on us.
Right, or the risk.
Yeah.
The physical risk. What's interesting, this week I saw a video that Iran had released to its people. You know, we were able to track it down to a video game. They were using images from some kind of war video game platform. And Khamenei keeps coming out and saying that the attack is imminent. The attack is imminent. They're going to attack imminently, except it's been, I guess, 2 weeks now. Again, I say all the time, time is an illusion for me. I have no idea where we're traveling in time right now. But it feels like it was about 2 weeks ago where they came out and said there's going to be retribution. And there hasn't been any. And I almost wonder if the damage that's been done to their infrastructure, their leadership hierarchy, because we have done damage to that over the last 8 years, 7 years, if that has in some way interfered with their perceived military might, and that are they not capable of carrying out a full-scale attack like they've been promising their people? Or, I mean, because they've been talking about it endlessly for weeks now. They released this video. It's video game imagery. They still haven't attacked. So I have questions now as to what are they waiting for? What is it that they are, you know, waiting to occur? Is there another attack that they want before they do strike Israel or our resources in the region? But I know I read this week we were deploying 4,000. We deployed a strike force carrier group to the Middle East this week. So we're preparing as if their threats are real, but they've just not come to fruition yet. So I wonder what they're waiting for. The rumors I've heard is their nuclear program is not as robust as we believe it is or have been led to believe it is. You know, does it go further than that? It's such a, we have so little intel out of that region that it's just an interesting thing to watch the different steps that they're taking come to pass.
Yes, that is a perfect scenario in question, because we also have to look at the other side of the equation and recognize that these nations don't come without their own problems and faults and things like that. So when you narrow it down to just Iran, without getting into the broader picture throughout Asia and basically the world, their military is not very good. Their military is basically a giant national police force that's focused mostly on controlling their own population.
Yes.
They're largely incapable of doing an external type of a military mission that people in America are used to, expeditionary forces going across water or multiple nations and through the air to attack another nation. That's not Iran's thing, because their biggest threat is, in reality, internal.
Sure.
Uprisings.
Second, the same problem that we have in America with sending a lot of our stuff to other places and reducing our own stockpiles happened to Iran in April when they launched all those drones, missiles, UAVs, and various things like that at Israel and had every single one of them pretty much shot down. And to virtually zero effect. Well, that comes out of their stockpiles, and it's even harder for them to replenish those. So where are they getting it? Well, they're getting it out of a nation called Russia, who's already at war trying to defeat Ukraine, who have to look at this and say, what's our priority? Well, their priority is, of course, Ukraine. So, you know, Iran, you can have some of our knockoffs or, you know, our extra here and there. And so Iran is not living in a vacuum and that were to where they don't have weaknesses and faults and things that we can't use to take constructive advantage of to make sure that this doesn't happen. So there's a significant amount of risk to them continuing this conflict as well. And I think we have to go forward with Iran has greater capability in the nuclear world than they might, because it's always best to plan against the worst case.
Well,
so, and as soon as you expand that, though, then you're also starting to ask, you know, Iran's allies, China, This is not a monolithic nation with no problems either. They've got crashing currencies. Their economy is living on the edge, specifically within their realty and things like that, buildings and buildings and land stuff. You know, they're frankly more on an economic edge than we are. So as you continue, as you look at it, the world from the perspective of the United States, and kind of overlay our philosophies and how we function onto other nations, it can look to an extent pretty bad, because we think these nations are capable of doing the things we are.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not.
But they're not.
They're not designed that way. Even China is not designed to be an expeditionary military. They are much more so than Iran. But they're all focused internally, because thugs police their own people first.
Right.
Which is a great advantage for us. But one of the things we have to keep in mind is that over time, they can develop capabilities they don't have now. If you think back to the $400 million that Obama sent to them on a pallet in an airplane in the middle of the night, a story that broke in the Wall Street Journal at the time, some great reporting by them at the time. That was August of 2016.
Yeah.
Trump comes in, and to your point, Darren, he puts a tremendous crushing pressure on their economy and kind of removes them from the chessboard in terms of being an external threat. Now you get... and if you remember, in the first months of the Trump administration, John Kerry, the former Secretary of State of the United States of America, went to Iran to advise them on how to counter the United States.
Weird. He was never hit with a Logan Act violation there.
No. It's because, the people who do that liked him being there. So he goes over there to advise them on how to work against the U.S. And then, of course, the Trump administration comes to a conclusion. The Democrats seize power and Iran's back in the game with money flowing, with access to the oil markets. As you said, they're strengthening again. And just since that's happened, it's only been 3 short years, but just since that's happened, we've seen them grow more and more belligerent, their capabilities expanding. And there's no counter. There's no conceivable idea that this administration or that these pseudo experts that run our State Department and our military are going to go in and somehow create a positive outcome here. It's just our belligerence against theirs. And then we fund them and continue to drive them to make them more formidable. And we all remember the, nuclear deal that we were told was going to prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, which was clearly designed to get them the nuclear weapons. So it is hard for me to understand how we can expect any better outcomes unless we once again change out this administration and, not only, not have this radical Walls become vice president, but make the more radical than Biden, Harris, make sure she doesn't become president. I just see bad things coming if we put people like this in more power. I don't know if you've got a view on that.
Yes, these people are, whether it's Biden, Harris, they're all, like you said, they're all working for somebody anyways, and it's just more of the same, and that trend will continue. It'll continue to expand Iran's power.
Look like a ghost
and their financing. And oh, by the way,
that's awesome.
Think of Muslim nations dealing with the president.
Yeah, look at that.
Yeah.
Take a picture of that.
We've got our next, Darren, we've got our next guest lining up, and his mic's not muted.
Oh, that was awesome.
So we're hearing him get set up.
Okay, Joe, I got to get on here.
Here's your sign.
Yeah. I don't think he knew we could hear him, and I don't think he can hear us yet. But the point you were making was a critical one.
I'm still taking you, or is Jace taking you? Okay.
So the point that you were making is a critical one, and
I can't hear them, but I can.
we can hear you.
Okay,
Darren,
now I can hear him.
Great. Darren, I think we might have to just wrap this up. I apologize for the technical challenge here, but we're going to try to get you back on again for another conversation if you're willing to do so. In our last conversation, we were talking about that article that I mentioned at the beginning. So folks can find you on Substack by searching your name, Darren, D-A-R-I-N, Gaub, G-A-U-B. And the one article I think that is an easy read, but is really, I think, deep in its implications is Failure is the Plan. And I definitely want to get into that and walk through the rest of your thoughts, which we hadn't had time for this time because, as we had said, we wanted to focus on the just incredibly destabilized and challenging global situation here, where it just feels like 18 months after Trump was taken out of office, and from that moment till now,
chaos.
We've been talking about chaos and nations being toppled and the risk of nuclear war, and it's a different thing. And again, I don't know that the average American has yet perceived what I view as an incredibly troubling landscape, where the dangers are existential if we don't start changing our behavior and dealing with the world in a different way.
Yep.
So,
yep. Absolutely.
Well, again, we appreciate your time, Darren. Thanks for joining the Conservative Voice today. And we will look forward to getting you back on to continue this conversation. So,
yep, sounds good. And thanks to your listeners and audience for everything that they're doing. And please say hi. Please say hello to my good friend, Dave Clements.
And we will. And he is joining us now. So,
all right.
So as Darren exits,
hey, Darren.
We've got Professor David Clements joining. Professor Clements, thanks for joining us here on the Conservative Voice here in Philadelphia. As you know, we hosted you at an event. Now it's oddly enough, like
years ago.
It's years.
I feel like the last 3 years have been sort of suspended in time and not in reality, but
right.
Somehow in my mind, it's been just a blink of an eye.
It is
since
a snap.
2021.
It was October of 2021 when we met. And had you were part of a team that came in for a 4-hour event. It was supposed to be a shorter event, but the questions from the audience just kept flowing. We had, I think, 400 people in the room at that time.
Yeah.
No one
got up and left. Everyone stayed glued to their seats for the entire presentation. It was a late night.
It was a late night. Yeah. And it happened at a time where Americans had really realized, many of us had realized how much trouble we're in as a nation, and certainly that focus that evening was on the election system. And since that time, you've done a documentary and you've been out on the road and gone through lots of changes. We had you at a town hall as well, I think about a year and a half ago, maybe, something like that. It's hard, as you know, to...
Time is an illusion.
It is, to keep track of time. But welcome, and maybe just at the outset, if you could just kind of give us an update on what you've been up to, what's happening in your world.
Well, I think I'm working on my domestic terrorist bona fides by going out and telling people you don't have to put up with this nonsense for having local administrators and local clerks certifying defective processes and defective products. And so I've been spearheading this thing called the Gideon 300 training, and the vision is cast and let my people go. If people have seen that, there's a cool climax of all of these great citizens that are standing up at local meetings. But I couldn't make the movie another hour long to kind of flesh out what that looks like. And so I've been traveling state to state to equip and train people on how to hold the line at the certification level locally. And I think probably the best fruit of that, though I can't claim credit for it, but I've done Gideon 300 trainings in Georgia, is the latest battle between the Georgia Election Board and the corrupt governor, Brian Kemp, the corrupt Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. And you're seeing this great culmination where people are finally getting that the appropriate place to be having the debate on elections is not, convincing an entire legislature to see things the way that you see them.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to the person that's certifying that little black box device, running ballots through it, and saying, certification is supposed to mean something. This should mean that everything that I'm about to do, I can attest, I can defend. And the fact of the matter is, you can't defend these black boxes. And if you've got a canvassing board that's going to certify your local results, they should be bigger experts on the processes than I am. I mean, I don't live in Pennsylvania. I don't live in Georgia. Why is it that I know more about your machines and your processes than the people that are actually rubber stamping the results? And so that's probably what I spend most of my time doing. I go to almost every state that I've been to 47. I'll be to 48 states as of tomorrow. And there's 3,147 counties that we're trying to equip and train. And, it's not the best or sexiest message out there, but it's, I think it's needed. It's really we the people standing up and taking back our counties.
Well, and it is a critical message, and it is part of the discussion we had when you were here the first time in October of 2021.
And to be clear, Chester County Election Board has not reconciled an election since 2020.
Well, that's not just Chester County. That's all across Pennsylvania.
I'm just saying, yeah, for my personal knowledge, we have gone to that board after every election, every single year, and said, you still have unreconciled votes. You can't certify this election. It is against the law. And what do? They certify the election. So we've gone through it with our municipals, midterms, school board, you know, in 21, 22, 23, primaries and generals.
Yep.
And with primaries, we've gone to them with the idea of like, listen, we're not trying to take out your Democrat candidates. We're talking about our own Republican primaries. Just that alone, there's problems here. And yet still not able to get it.
Well, there's a group of people all across Pennsylvania in almost every county where you've got folks who did exactly what you just mentioned, that they are now experts in process, experts in voter rolls, experts in data, and experts in law. And I've been in county commissioner meetings where I've seen citizens stand up and read the law to commissioners who didn't know it. And those commissioners in some counties are the Board of Elections.
Yeah.
And in all counties, they're responsible for the elections, you know, whether they're on the board or the board reports to them. But it is astonishing, to your point, that they weren't anywhere near the level of expertise that you would have to be to effectively manage and certify elections. That was a stunning realization, I think, for the people who got involved in fighting for more secure and transparent elections back in 2021, 22.
Yeah, I think the lesson here, though, is to not quit, because it's easy to feel demoralized. But what I'm telling people is it's taken us 4 years to get to a place where we can have the conversation and withstand gaslighting. Because before you go to these meetings, it's like a vendor opens their mouth and they lie, and you're not really sure if they're lying or not. And then you go home feeling uncertain, or you've been going and you know what you're talking about, but you're by yourself, or it's the same three or four tired people that do all of the heavy lifting. What I haven't seen executed perfection is the scaling of numbers.
Yeah,
where we can show up to these meetings and say, okay, we're not going anywhere. So if we haven't been able to put a meeting on the agenda, or we're not dealing with arbitrary time limits, and most people, the biggest inhibitor to getting the truth out is you have 3 minutes to talk, and there's no way that you can articulate the problem in 3 minutes. And so we all look like rushed monkeys, you know, reading a script, and then we hand off the script to someone else. And if you're doing that, you've already lost, because they actually see your weakness. It's like, oh, they still haven't gotten, you know, they haven't figured out that they have the power and that the time limit's arbitrary. And there's a way to lift that time limit. There's a way to put this on an agenda and have independent experts that aren't from Dominion or ESNS or Hart. And it's just a matter of numbers. Every place that we've seen where there's been a victory against the machine vendors or mass mandates wasn't because I showed up or you had some eloquent speaker or some nerd that had all the data. It was usually an angry mob of like pissed off moms. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where what do we take from that? Like, we have to get away from this idea that this is just a debate based on reason. And we're going to have this good faith discussion and somehow they'll listen to us. They're not going to listen to anything that obstructs their power. And unfortunately, the only thing that I know of that will get their attention are mobilized patriots that show up and basically perfect exposure campaigns by having video clips of the dynamic between a bought and paid for commission and we the people. And that means you have to increase the numbers of people that show up to those meetings. You have to increase your reach on social media. You have to create new avenues of press, because the state news press isn't going to cover those hearings in a true fashion. So you have to be able to create your own citizen podcast force. And if you do that and have the same relentless dedication to telling the truth that they do to telling lies, you're going to have some victories. And so the end of Let My People Go I'm very proud of the fact that it ends on a very hopeful note of victory, of mass resignations of registrars of voters. People don't know this in California. There's 58 counties, and over the past four years, I think 24 of those registrars of voters have resigned under pressure campaigns like this. So there are victories. We just, it's like we've gotten so numb to the corruption that we can't appreciate when we're winning.
Well, I think you make an important point that the numbers are critical. And if you don't have a lot of people, they do not pay attention. They we all know that these politicians focus on two things, money and numbers. And they can handle 100 to 200 people even. If they don't get the feeling that the concern is spread to a much bigger population, then they scoff at it. You see that in the fights in the school boards. You see that in the fights in the boards of elections, where they completely disregard the populace. Now, what we've seen here in Southeast Pennsylvania is, and across Pennsylvania really, is continued efforts, not just at the county commissioner meetings or board of elections meetings, but we've seen litigation in counties across the state. And some of it has been more successful. All of it has kept the pressure on so that they know that the people who are active have not gone away, have not forgotten. They're not free from observation. We've had a lot of success in Pennsylvania with the analysis of the voter rolls to find out then where are, for example, the people that have moved. There was a great effort in 2022 after that election where a selection of voters who were on the U.S. Postal Service change of address list were selected and through desktop analysis, you know, looking at their records and real estate documents and so on, and actual door knocking, canvassing those doors, it was shown that, yes, many of these people voted illegally, and many of those voted in person, which always surprises people who are aware of the risks of mail-in ballots. So there has been progress. There's been great work done, really smart people that have worked really hard, and that's encouraging. But the bigger battle, you still have in charge at the state level and at the county levels, you still got people in charge who fight every effort to increase transparency and security of the election process. They just fight it. And then if you were just thinking casually and said, wait a minute, why would anyone fight against the improvement of the security and transparency of the election system? Why would anyone fight to not release, for example, records that are designated public records?
And not identifiable at all.
Do not identify the voters at all. Why would anyone not support that effort, especially somebody who's responsible for things like elections? So I think you make a really good point. I mean, there is a way to win, but it does take persistence, it takes numbers, and it takes development of the skills necessary. A lot of that has happened in Pennsylvania, but not enough to win the overall battle to where we can say,
yeah. It comes down to lawful nullification. And that's why I keep going back to these local boards, because you're right. They will hide behind different layers of bureaucracy. Like, well, we can't do anything. We can't get rid of the machine vendor because the SOS has legal authority. And it's this pivot and punting strategy where you're just left in limbo. And so the reason why I keep sticking with, okay, that's fine, but what about your responsibility, Madam Clerk? What about your responsibility, canvassing board? Because if they say no, you throw a giant monkey wrench into the system and you create actually a healthy constitutional crisis, which is you're not going to use me as a pawn to give you the veneer that this is some robust system where we're really protecting the vote, when you're basically keeping a gun to my head saying that I have to rubber stamp a process that I know is defective. I have to rubber stamp a machine that I know is defective. And one of the things that's shocking for me as a lawyer is that when I used to teach contract law, or I have to teach, you know, criminal law about plea deals, there's all kinds of things that can upend the viability of a law. And as soon as something facilitates fraud, I don't care what your code says. It ceases to have effect. It's null and void by virtue of something entering into the process that destroys the mechanics of it. You know, so one of the examples that I can give you is, let's say that I want to buy your house from you. You want to sell me your house, and you draw up a real estate contract that's 8 pages long. And while you're not looking, I take out page 8 and I reinsert something that looks just like it, but all of a sudden the terms are a little bit more favorable to me than they were to you, and you missed it. And later on, you take a look at the contract, you're saying, you know something, this doesn't look right. This doesn't look like the agreed upon contract. Well, if you catch me and you say, you know something, I don't like what Professor Clements did, but I really want to get rid of this house. And you pull me aside and you say, Professor Clements, I know what you did. What do you mean? I know that you switched those numbers on that last page, but damn it, I want to get rid of this house. And so I'm going to go ahead and go through with the contract. Now, if I were to say, I don't like being outed and exposed by you, I'm like, that's fine. I'll just do business with someone else. And you brought that contract to a judge signed by both of us. It would be unenforceable as a matter of law because that's called fraud in the execution. It's called fraud by sleight of hand. There's no way to rehab and make that contract work. So now parlay that over to elections. You have fraud in the execution by virtue of defective products. You also have fraud in the inducement where people are being lied to sign contracts that, yeah, you can use these machines because you'll always have access to the paper ballots until what? You ask for them.
Right.
So if you don't give me what you promised me and use that as an inducement for me to enter into a contract to fund things at the county level, and then you change your mind, that's fraud. And anyone that's ever been in the contract space knows it's fraud and it's unenforceable. And then the other thing is this, is that you got people that are now going on record, clerks and canvassing boards saying, I was just notified that if I don't certify this vote tomorrow, that I'm going to be arrested for a felony. Well, that's duress. Well, duress renders agreements unenforceable.
Right.
So there's so many ways to slice this up and protect people legally. This is not lawlessness that I'm proposing. This is actually adherence to tried and true, legal doctrines that have been around for hundreds of years. And that's what we're trying to undergird these local administrators with, that, you know, you just need to do the right thing and let the chips fall where they may.
You know, one of the challenges we face is of course, having people in office who want to do the right thing, who aren't in some way incented or encouraged or somehow part of a machine that drives them down the path of doing the wrong thing. And we see that a lot. We see people who were...
Our judges of elections.
Well, I'm thinking...
In the last election, they all got a text saying, don't you dare hand count those ballots. You're not allowed to hand count those ballots.
Well, that's a fair point. So we had a group of judges of elections who were intending to do a hand count because they were doing a certification on an ESNS machine that said, I certify that the results on this tape that comes out of the machine accurately reflect what the ballot showed. But in fact, they would have no way to know that. All they know is that the tape came out of a machine and they signed it blindly. Once that became known and judges of elections began to realize that they were certifying something they could not possibly know, could not possibly certify, many of them then pulled back and said, well, wait a minute, I don't want to certify this, or said, I will now go verify and validate those results. I'll just do a hand count at my precinct. Some precincts have a few hundred ballots. It's not that hard. But the government sent them a notice and said, if you do that, you will be prosecuted. Now, again, why would the government be consistently fighting against transparency unless there's a reason?
You keep asking these questions that you know the answer to. Well, you know the answer.
And the answer really goes back. And so, I get accused all the time of, like, fomenting, the mob. And really all I'm doing is saying, can you show up and talk to people plainly about all the things that we're talking about right now? And the only comparable thing that you can point to is like what the founding fathers went through. They petitioned lawlessness of their time. They sent the olive branch petition to King George. And a lot of the stuff that we're describing is like we're providing our olive branch petition to a bunch of local administrators that have no clue what they're doing. And they don't care because they have a monopoly on force, right? Because at the end of the day, no matter what you do, they've got the badges and the guns. And because we're smart people, we calculate. There's a reason why I'm not going to that meeting, because I'll be removed, or I'll have someone put their hands on me, or they'll write a bad article. And until we conquer that roadblock, you're gonna continue to have the same dynamic that we've been complaining about for the past 4 years. And so in some ways, I feel like I'm trying to provide people with their training wheels on how to rediscover that patriot spirit of, okay, wait a minute. What does the Declaration of Independence say when you're a state of tyranny? What is required to replenish that tree of liberty? What was the buy-in for many states that did not want to become part of the U.S. government, like Kentucky and Virginia? You actually look at their ratifying conventions. They were saying, well, how do we know that you're not going to go too far? Yeah, you've got this constitution and it's got, you know, Article 1, Section 8 and 18 enumerated powers. But what happens if you start legislating outside of those powers? Well, the authors, Madison, Jefferson, said, well, you're duty bound to nullify. You're actually duty bound to basically say no. And that's just the thing that we haven't quite captured as an American society in 2024, is that we have a duty to say no to fraud. We have a duty to say no to these things. And the only thing that separates the founders from us is that they actually were willing to risk their reputations, their fortunes, their lives. We like posting bumper stickers on our cars, telling people that we're patriots. But when push comes to shove, we don't want to go to places and have, you know, people do and say mean things to us. And until we can conquer that fear, I think, unfortunately, we're going to continue to just be professional complainers about Rome burning.
Well, again, there are folks that have filed litigation and taken real action, folks that have gone to these meetings and pressured their elected officials to take action. I mean, there are folks that have done a lot and put their shoulder to the wheel. But to your broader point, I think, is correct. For most of the United States, the American citizen is just too comfortable and is willing to accept things. You know, you mentioned that a lot of this is mothers, and certainly in the school battles, we saw that. We see it in the election side as well. And you have to ask the question, where are the fathers? Where are they? You know,
working.
Why are they not out there? We've got about 5 minutes left, and I've got just to help people understand better, we still have a lot of folks that say there is no election fraud or there's no evidence of election fraud. In your documentary, Let Our People Go, you mentioned Project 65. You know, is it the case that there's no election fraud and that all these court cases have proven that there's no evidence?
No. And you know, so I'm one of the few attorneys in the country that actually have read close to 400 plus election fraud lawsuits related to 2020.
Mm-hmm.
Not all of them are built equally. Some of them, or most of them, were filed by pro se candidates and people that couldn't afford attorney. But in the film, we showcase about 90 lawsuits that were filed by the RNC, Trump, the GOP.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the 90, only about 30, I think that number's ticked up to 32 since the film, had been set for merits hearings. And out of those 30 to 32 cases, Trump won 24, or the RNC, Trump, GOP have won 24 on the merits. Now, that dispels and debunks the myth of the 65 Project. But there's a larger problem. When you start looking at the cases that were taken up on the merits, they were all cases that weren't outcome determinative. So what that tells me is that the judges are willing to take on cases that are window dressing. Like,
yeah,
if you've got an issue here that's not going to affect some, you know, candidate's voter base, we'll enter in that fray. But everything else, you're just going to run for the hills. So there is proof if you can get it, but even if you have proof, doesn't mean that you're not going to be railroaded. I mean, look at Trump. Look at the prosecutions against him, whether it's Alvin Bragg or Fannie Willis. He's not getting a fair trial. I've been covering Tina Peters' case, and 94% of the objections lodged by the state against Tina Peters have been sustained. So she's not able to put on her case. Rudy Giuliani, America's mayor, a guy that I know presented long testimony in Pennsylvania early on in the process, was hit with a $148 million verdict. So this isn't about truth being known, because we know we're carrying the day. If you talk to everyday citizens, they agree with us. You look at the polling.
Oh, yeah.
You know, a clear majority of Americans know that we've got problems. So I'll give you some victories, but they're not necessarily in the courtroom. You've got Elon Musk. 190 million people with the largest social media following on planet Earth is saying the same things that we are now.
Yeah.
Get rid of the machines. Get back to paper routes. That's not an insignificant thing with a guy with that size of a megaphone. You've got Joe Rogan who's come around. You've got all kinds of people that have occupied this large social media space that are now in lockstep with a majority of Americans. And that took us 3 years to achieve.
Yes, it did.
So we can take our tinfoil hats off and say, you know, look, they've gotten with the program. It's time for our judges to do the same.
Yeah, it's not just a group of radicals who are upset about Trump. You know, it is actually, if you look at the polling, Rasmussen does some great polling. It is a majority and a big majority of the American population that think this has been a problem and that it's going to affect the 2024 outcome. We've got about a minute left. What's next for you? Where you said you're traveling to your 48th state, I think, tomorrow. Where could people find you?
Yeah. Well, you can find me on at theprofessorsrecord.com is my website. So if you're on different social media platforms, just go to the very bottom of the screen. You can find, let my people go there. But I'm heading to Wheatland, Wyoming tomorrow.
Ah.
I'll be in Dallas, Texas next week. After that, I'll be in Georgia. I'm going to be in Canton, Pennsylvania, I think September 8th. So every week I fly someplace new and do the same training.
That's great. Well, you know, we appreciate you having stayed in the fight. I know that you, you know, have paid a price for this, as everyone who's done it has. And it's great that we have you still in it. And we're really glad we got a chance to connect with you today. Hopefully we'll reconnect in a future episode. But as we look forward to 2024, in my view, all the work that's been done actually increases the odds of a successful outcome, let's say. We're really out of time, so we've got to jump. But thank you so much, Professor David Clements, for joining us on The Conservative Voice on WWDB AM 860 in Philadelphia. Good afternoon, everybody.
Thank you.